Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And in 2015, Emory University philosophy professor George Yancey published a series of 19 interviews with philosophers and public intellectuals on the issue of race for the New York Times philosophy forum, The Stone. His aim was to engage in a very public space with what he calls the often unnamed elephant in the room, race. Now he's come out with an expanded collection of those interviews in a book called On Race, 34 Conversations in a Time of Crisis. The book includes conversations with major thinkers like Judith Butler, Cornel West, Kwame Anthony Appiah, Peter Singer, and Noam Chomsky. And those conversations go deep, interrogating race's insidious expressions, its transcendence of black-white binaries, its ethical implications, and ultimately, its future. But it's also very practical. We all need to be more self-aware and to talk to each other better. George Yancey is here to talk with us now about some of what he's learned since talking to so many influential thinkers on the topic of race in America today, and to help facilitate a hopefully constructive conversation when we open the phones in just a minute. Hi, George Yancey. Welcome back to WNYC.
How are you? Thanks for having me again.
Let me start with the time during your series of interviews that you wrote a public letter in the New York Times called Dear White America. In that letter, you start off with your own admission. You write, I am sexist. And then you go on to write, I have failed women. I have failed to speak out when I should have. I have failed to engage critically and extensively their pain and suffering in my writing. I continue to falter and I continue to oppress. And even though the ways in which I oppress women is unintentional, this does not free me of being responsible. And you go on, if you are white and you're reading this letter, I ask that you don't run to seek shelter from your own racism. Don't hide from your responsibility. Rather, begin right now to practice being vulnerable. Being neither a good white person nor a liberal white person will get you off the proverbial hook. I consider myself to be a decent human being, yet I'm sexist, you wrote. So talk to me about that tactic. In starting this letter to White America, which sets the backdrop for this project that you're conducting on conversations about race, you first admit that you are sexist. What were you trying to do?
Yeah, sure. Good question. Hearing it back to me frightens me a bit, the level of vulnerability. But I think in Dear White America, I want it basically to model for white people what it means to be vulnerable. And I love etymology, so if you look up the word vulnerable, it means to be wounded. So I was wanting them to get a sense of what it meant to be wounded and to think about, you know, ways in which one happens to be in the world where one is not proud of that form of being. But yet, you know, so when I say I'm a sexist, the point is that I engage in acts of sexually objectifying women. I fail them when it comes to speaking out on their behalf. Now, it's not quite like, you know, I'm not saying that I'm guilty of what Harvey Weinstein has been accused of. I'm not making that point. But it doesn't let me off the proverbial hook. So I wanted white people to see what courage looks like. I wanted to speak what philosophers refer to as parhesia, which is a Greek word which means to speak courage or to speak courageously or to tell it all. I wanted white people to see what removing the mask looks like. I relied there on James Baldwin, who talks about how love takes off masks that we are afraid that we can't live without, and yet know we can't live with. And I had bell hooks in mind, where she talks about love involving telling the truth about ourselves and telling it to others. So you might say that in talking about my own sexism, in revealing it openly and publicly, was really a way of enacting a form of love and being vulnerable. And I wanted to disarm white readers because I knew what I was arguing would be so controversial, because I was arguing that to be white in America is to be racist. But the vulnerability didn't work. I mean, there were moments when I got incredibly beautiful letters, but for the most part, the letters that I received, the postcards that I received, the voice messages that I received, were all fundamentally filled with white vitriolic hatred in terms of what white people wanted to do to me, in terms of the names that they called me, et cetera, et cetera. And just let me make a quick distinction. When I say that white people are racist, I recognize that not all white people are part of the Klan or neo-Nazis. That's clear to me, and I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is that to the extent that our nation is predicated upon white supremacy and the extent to which white privilege continues to exist, there are ways in which white people get to live their lives in ways in which black people and people of color won't. So that, for an example, take Anderson Cooper on CNN, right? When they're talking about Charlottesville recently, he had a group of black pundits on to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, okay, here's one, white host and the black pundits. They're all talking about something that they agree about, namely the racism, the overt, vicious racism in the form of KKK neo-Nazis. But here's the problem. Racism exists right there in that studio. To the extent that an Anderson Cooper is a privileged white man, and what happens is that he fails to talk about that with the pundits there, right, who have come there to talk about racism. So what I'm saying is that what we really need to do is we shouldn't completely bracket out those spectacular moments of white racism that happened in Charlottesville. We should focus on those, but we should look at the non-spectacular forms of white racism and white privilege that, let's say, gets embodied in someone like an Anderson Cooper vis-a-vis his black pundits.
Given the story that you just told and the way you wrote about yourself and sexism, why not call it white privilege or male privilege rather than racism or sexism? Somebody there are a lot of people out there who are white and or male who are trying very consciously to be woke, part of which involves acknowledging acknowledges our privileges and multiple privileges, but that potentially is different from saying all whites or all men are racist and sexist, which I think implies more of of an attitude, and maybe that's why some people were put off.
Sure, and I think you're right, but here's the problem with that. I think that there is what might be called a perpetrator model of white racism, where there's the idea that you have to meet certain kinds of conditions to be a racist, right? You have to have a certain kind of attitude toward the world. You have to have a certain set of beliefs that can be clearly defined as racist. You have to have certain kinds of intentions. But my definition of racism, or better yet, my description of white racism, goes beyond that, and it must, only because if we define it in those terms, then only the Klan or neo-Nazis who are self-avowed racists, who clearly hold racist beliefs, would be considered racist, whereas the other whites who don't espouse those views, let's call them the good whites, would be let off the hook. They wouldn't be called racists. So my description of racism then goes beyond intentionality and goes beyond attitude, and it says something like this. The critical educational theorist Barbara Applebaum, and she's a white Jewish woman, and she says that the problem with white racism is that white people see themselves as good. That's precisely the problem. And so what I'm suggesting is that racism is more like a continuum, and that you fall on that continuum. But in falling on the continuum, it doesn't let you off the hook in terms of falling within a society that structurally positions you in such a way that you, even if unconsciously or unintentionally, perpetuate forms of racialized violence. So to give you a very practical example, if I walk into a store and the white security guard follows me and leaves, let's say, you to shop as a white person, now you might say, well, wait, you're not the security guard. You're not the white security guard. You didn't follow me, so therefore you're not racist. But according to the sort of robust description that I give, you get to shop. But when you get to shop, that means that you get to live your life and move through space with effortless grace, whereas I have to be attentive to the ways in which my body is being profiled. But you are also granted a certain kind of ethical status. In other words, you're not a thief, whereas I'm a thief. But you see, that whole construction implicates you as a white man in my oppression. And to the extent that that happens, you therefore become racist because you perpetuate, as it were, the invisible contract that says, I am the one who is guilty of being a potential thief. And even if you were to say, look, I will fight on your behalf if you observe that. Well, here's the problem. For me, the best that I can be is an anti-sexist sexist. So I can fight against sexism, but I'm still a sexist at the end of the day. Why is that? Because part of being in a structure and being a male oppresses women. And also, my consciousness, the ways in which we as men are bombarded by images of women from commercials to movies, literature, you name it, to see them as sexual objects. So we fragment them, even when we don't intend to do so. So the best that white people can be, in, on my view, are anti-racist racists. So I'm not arguing that white people can't be racist, that they can't be woke, as you put it nicely. But at the end of the day, because they're still a part of a system, and, as I argue, because they can't know the limits of their own racism, they're still a part of the racist problem. If I can just give you one more example, Tim Wise, who's Tim Wise, who's written quite a bit on white privilege, and he considers himself to be an ally, a white ally. He considers himself to be someone who is woke. But he talks about this, or he gives this example where he's going to get on an airplane, and he gets on the airplane, and he walks by the cockpit, and he sees that there are two African-American pilots. And he says, no matter what I thought to be true, the thought popped into my head, oh my God, can these guys fly this plane? Right? So there's this incredible moment where if had we asked Tim Wise, let's say, 3 seconds before he saw the pilots, if you saw two black pilots, what would you say? He would probably give a self-report and say, well, wonderful, I've never, flown on a plane with black pilots, or we're making progress, or something of the sort. But he didn't say that. He said, and he says, no matter what I knew to be the case, so there it is, right? I knew it to be true. Despite that fact, there is the emergence of this very deeply problematic racist assumption about the qualification of black pilots.
My guest is Emory University philosophy professor George Yancey, whose new book is On Race, 34 Conversations in a Time of Crisis. And when we come back from a break, we'll take a caller, and our lines are almost full without me even having given out the phone number, but we'll take a caller who voluntarily showed up to say that your Dear White America letter in the New York Times inspired her to write a similar letter. So we'll hear with that what that caller has to say with George Yancey right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Emory University philosophy professor George Yancey, author of On Race, 34 Conversations in a Time of Crisis. And as promised, Sandra in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Professor Yancey. Hi, Sandra. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to let Professor Yancey know that when I first read your letter, I was inspired at that moment to write a letter talking about why I was a white racist, and I could essentially insert, everywhere that you wrote that you were a sexist, a male sexist, I could say that I was a white female racist and use the same logic. And the reason I came to that was because I'm married to a black man and I have biracial children. We live in Brooklyn. And when I talk to my family and I talk to about, racism, they don't get it. They'll say, we're not racist, and they can't possibly get it, because when I first met my husband, he said, do you think you're racist? And I said, absolutely not. Do you think things are better, 20 years ago for blacks than whites? And I said, no, you guys have, total opportunity. And I just didn't get it till I walked in his shoes and literally lived his life and lived my children's life, you know, and since then I've steeped myself in, you know, literature about race relations in this country. You know, one of my favorite books is Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Another Sun. So I haven't actually written the letter, but I've written it in my head, and I thought that, you know, what needs to happen is for white allies like myself to come out and explain, like you came out, and have the courage to say, hey, we are racist too. And that would have a more powerful impact.
Maybe since your book is all about, and your project is all about conversations, you want to talk to each other a little. Professor Yancey?
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you for that. I mean, here it is. I think you're absolutely right. The term ally, the reason I like the term ally, and I said earlier that I really love etymologies, and the term ally means to bind to. And that's the sort of the beauty of that term. So there's a kind of binding that we have when we're able to speak the truth and tell the truth about ourselves, and to have the other, in this case, the other discussant, the other person, to be able to hear and be prepared and have the capacity to hear that truth. And I think that's so important. So that's kind of what we're doing at the moment. And I should share with you that Jane Lazar has written a book on her experiences as a white mother of black sons. And what's interesting, and it links with this point that you made about your earlier consciousness about the absence of your racism or being not racist, there was a moment where her son was being harassed by a police officer, and she saw this from her window as she was looking out the house. And she was just really, you know, obviously as a mother, concerned. And so her son finally came home, walked through the door, and she was just, you know, erratic, screaming, yelling, saying, how could this happen to you, et cetera, et cetera. And he says to his mother, he says, Mom, this always happens to me, right, as a black boy.
Right.
And at this moment, as a white mother of a black son, she goes, oh my, how did I miss this? But she goes on to talk about how, even though she loves this boy to death, right, her black mm-hmm. son, she did not understand what it meant for him to be black in a world in which she gets privilege. In fact, her response itself, right, was indicative of white privilege, that how could this happen
exactly.
to you? Yeah.
I just want to make one other point real quickly, and that is that, you know, I think first you have to own it. And, you know, because sure. I think most people don't even understand how they're racist. They don't understand what white privilege is. They really, sure. and that's because they don't experience the other side of not being privileged. All they know is that privilege. And I have to say, I've struggled to understand it, you know, over the past 20 years, what that means. And it wasn't until I listened to Renee Brown, she did a Facebook talk, which is worth listening to. And she said, you know, white privilege is when you grow up and, you know, everyone on TV looks like you. When you go to the store that, you know, there are dolls that look like you. White privilege is being able to go to a hotel room and bring, you know, 10 cases of guns up to the hotel room and not ever be asked.
No, absolutely. White privilege is so close. It's like breathing air. It's like gravity. It just holds you in place and you never sort of question it. And, you know, I argue that in the letter, Dear White America, I offered a gift. That's what I called it.
Exactly.
And it's a gift that I didn't have to give, you know. The notion of a gift has rich theological meaning, and of course I didn't intend it that way, but it does. It's a heavy gift, though. It's something that one must bear, but it's the gift of the black gaze. It's just like women who offer their gaze for men. We have to begin to see ourselves through their gaze, through their vision. And so white people must begin to see themselves through the gaze and through the lived experiences and the turmoil of black people. And
I don't think they can do that until white people take them along to do it.
Sandra, thank you so much for your call.
You.
I really, really appreciate it. And let's get one more conversation going here in our remaining 3 minutes or so. Al in Bergen County, you're on WNYC with George Yancey. Hi, Al.
Hello, Brian. Love the show.
Hey.
I think the professor is playing an intellectual game to no positive purpose. I don't know what is well served by telling me that just being my white being makes me a racist. I think it's very counterproductive. And I would I'd like to ask the professor, is he a racist just because of his black existence?
Sure. Excellent point. Of course, you and I completely disagree about this. I am not playing an intellectual game. In fact, I would say that's really an insult to the project because, one, what I'm trying to do is to liberate white people from a consciousness that they don't even understand exists, and it is difficult for them to understand that it exists because of the history of white supremacy that protects them from this knowledge. So what I'm doing is very dangerous. It's the sort of thing that Socrates practiced in Athens when he went around in the Emporium and asked people what is the meaning of virtue and the meaning of justice. He's like a gadfly. So I'm like a gadfly in that regard. Now, to say that you are racist in terms of your being white, it's not to say that you were born racist. I mean, that would be a ridiculous claim. I have white friends, right? And these white friends, I wouldn't say to them that it is in the nature of your being white because you lack melanin that therefore you are a racist. That's not the point. The point is to give a rich historical and social analysis of how your body as white is privileged over mine. My chances of being profiled and stopped by a police officer are very different from yours. My chances of being profiled and stopped while I'm shopping are very different from yours.
Well, can I just jump in because we have 60...
That's exactly right, and I agree with you about that.
Go ahead, Al.
But telling white people that they are racist obscures your real and very powerful concerns.
No, I think that in a world in which black people are suffering, in a world in which we are suffering, particularly under a president like Donald Trump, where we are in a moral crisis, as Rabbi Abraham Heschel put it, I think that telling the truth is important. So if you can't grapple with the truth that you are a racist, then I think that we need to have another conversation. I need to talk to those whites who are prepared to be vulnerable, and I don't think you're prepared to be vulnerable.
Well, there we leave it. And Al, thank you very much for your call. In 15 seconds, is the time of crisis that you refer to in your book title, does that refer to Trump, even though I think almost all these conversations you had for the book were before the election?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes and no. And by that, I mean black people have always been in a state of crisis. America has always been in a state of crisis because it has refused to have a serious conversation about race.
George Yancey, Emory University philosophy professor, his new book On Race, 34 Conversations in a Time of Crisis. And after this segment, maybe it was 37. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.